areas that were
contested or where the Vietnamese were trying to recruit people to be weapon or ammunition carriers down the trail, or where they were coming in and killing school teachers and medics because they were trained by us in an attempt to, you know, use scare tactics with the village, to find out where the pressure was so great that we should probably move those people so that an entire village would be wiped out by the North Vietnamese. And if there was a sense that people needed to move because the lives of women and children were in danger, then our job was to figure out where to move them to, and then to move them either along a trail or by helicopter or by other means. And once they were moved, to resettle them, which meant clean houses, setting up agricultural land, getting them seasoned tools, building a clinic, training a new medic if their medic had been killed, training school teachers, and everything that goes along with helping them start a new life.
Mm-hmm.
So that was essentially the job.
Mm-hmm. Did you push many bales of rice out of the back of a C-119?
I didn't push many out, but I was certainly on the ground a lot when they were being pushed out.
Mm-hmm.
The way that system worked is that you would overfly an area that needed rice, and people had been trained to put out a certain signal, like a white CA, a Charlie Alpha, or a white Zulu, or whatever. Every village had a signal.
Mm-hmm.
So the plane would circle two or three times. The people would put out the marker on the landing strip. And the whole reason for that was to try to determine whether the village was safe or whether it had been compromised and the North Vietnamese had taken it over.
Uh-huh.
Of course, there's always a chance if taken over that they would learn the signal, but you looked at village activity. If they put out the right signal, but you didn't see anyone walking in the village, you didn't see anyone on the trails, that was a pretty good sign that even though the signal was right, there was something wrong there. So there's a very complicated process for determining whether you made a rice drop or not.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly was a part of that, usually in terms of sending out the airplanes, making sure the pilots had the right signals, and often being on the ground to make sure that things worked okay on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But we had another program which was much more interesting. In all of the areas around the refugee areas that were deemed relatively safe that were growing rice, we had a program to go out and buy rice from the friendly villages and distribute that rice to surrounding villages. We actually flew out in helicopters with, you know, burlap bags full of KIP, the Laotian money, KIP, would land at the airstrip with our scales and our money. And people would come up and sell their rice. We would buy it for cash and take it to the surrounding villages. That was much better than dropping it out of the plane.
Yes, yes. And what were your relationships with village headmen and provincial officials in those areas?
There were not many provincial officials.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking when I asked the question.
These were all Hmong villagers.
Right.
The Hmong had their own clan structure,
right,
their own traditional villagers, so there wasn't very much of a Lao government,
right,
a village structure, bureaucracy in place.
Mm-hmm.
So usually what would happen is you would go out to a village and meet with a village headman. The village headman usually had some kind of direct relationship with the military commander in that area. I had very little contact with the military commanders except in a few cases where the military commander was also kind of the head honcho for everything.
Mm-hmm.
When we stayed, a lot of times we would get dropped off at a village with a plan to walk from one village to another and get picked up 3 days later, or if it was a safe area, to basically stay in that village to get picked up 3 days later. So you had to have a good relationship with the people because your life life depended on it. They were the ones that told you that the North Vietnamese are really just 2 or 3 hours away and they might come in tonight knowing that you're here,
mm-hmm.
which would necessitate your moving somewhere else. So, yeah, the relationship was quite close and intimate and certainly very important for your own welfare.
Mm-hmm. And you and I both know the answer, what was the course of these operations until you left Laos, from then until you left Laos?
Well,
were they showing some signs of success, but the North Vietnamese were advancing in terms of territory? Because eventually the area's evacuated.
Yeah, no, it was extremely frustrating, because especially as you look on it in retrospect, one of the things that you were doing is essentially depopulating areas that were contested areas.
Mm-hmm.
Because the women and children that were the refugees that we were moving were the dependents of the military people.
Mm-hmm.
So once you move the women and children to a safer area, the will to fight for that territory was gone, and basically you're ceding that area to the North Vietnamese. So
mm-hmm.
over the time that I was there, what it meant was every year you would move refugees, you would help to resettle them, they would get their crops back in, and the next year the North Vietnamese would advance some more and they would move again, and after the second or third move they lost a lot of will to go out and burn the rice fields and plant again and build houses and
mm-hmm.
all that. So yeah, it was in a spiraling decline because, and I guess, again, this is where we part company in terms of philosophy, we were doing nothing. The U.S. was doing nothing to directly support the Hmong military. And we were providing them with weapons and even moving them around a bit. But in terms of airstrikes to help them, every place was off limits. You had to go to a bombing officer in the embassy. Even if you knew there was a cave full of Vietnamese armaments, the chances of being able to get an airstrike in on it was zero. And so we were helping them to fight, but not helping them enough to win.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think the United States was doing that?
Well, I think it was just the rules of engagement that were set out by the Congress. And it was really helping them fight a defensive fight. If they were in a position that we felt was important, we would supply them to the extent that we could supply them to fend off the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
That when they wanted to move forward and take an area to give themselves greater security, we would not support that, nor let them do it, nor provide them with supplies to do it, because the rules of engagement said that they were there for defensive action, not for offensive action.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was there, I remember once at the Hmong on their own, decided that they were going to go out on the Plain of Jars and take Siem Quangville back. And I think they basically did that, and they couldn't get any support to stay there. They couldn't get U.S. support to remain out there because that was an offensive action, and they had to retreat. So that was just the way the war was fought, and that was extremely frustrating, especially to the Hmong and for people that worked with the Hmong. I guess, like myself, that was not so political. It was frustrating because of their frustration.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, very early on when I started working on the refugee program for POP, one of the areas that I worked in was with the Lao Tung, the Ka,
mm-hmm.
and rather than the Hmong. And I used to go out to Lao Tung villages. The head of that group was named Xieng Man Noi. I don't know how you spell his name. Xieng Man Noi. And I would sit around his house with village elders at night, and my interest was in the Lao Tung, you know, where they came from, what their traditional stories were, you know, how their language different from the Lao language, how they saw themselves in relationship to the Hmong and to the Lolan Lao and all of those kind of things. And that's the kind of questions I would ask around the fires at night. And I remember one night, Xieng Man Noi said, you know, it's really interesting. When the North Vietnamese are here, they tell us about what a bright future is going to be when we drive all of the imperialist devils out of Laos. Mm-hmm. And everyone will be equal, and everyone will have rice and pigs and cows, and what a wonderful time it will be. And you only talk about the past and history. I think they're winning the battle for our hearts and minds because they're talking about the future and promise and the good life. And I got on the plane and left, and remembering, you know, that conversation and thinking, you know, I'm not a political person. I've never been a political person, but I'm in a political situation. It was just a revelation to me that there was a battle going on out there, and I was part of that battle. But no one was telling me what my role was. I didn't have a script to read. And I wasn't even aware that there was a role that I was playing in this war. I was doing what I thought I was supposed to do, which was helping people in need. And then it came to me crystal clear, not from any political operatives somewhere in the U.S. government, yeah, but from the people on the ground, that perhaps I wasn't doing everything I was supposed to do. Now, you can't change your basic nature, and that didn't change my basic nature. Uh-huh. But it certainly was a revelation. Hmm.
And I guess that before we leave Laos, what was your impression of... less of an impression, but what did you think about Central Intelligence Agency operations in Laos generally, and the place of USAID in the CIA's management style and operations?
Well, you know, I had somewhat limited contact, uh-huh, with CIA officers. I guess the ones that I had contact with, I was very impressed with, because they had a number of development programs where they were also helping the Hmong in much the way that USAID or IBS would. I mean, importing purebred hogs to upgrade livestock and, mm-hmm, things like that, directly with villages that were largely populated by their soldiers and military dependents. And those are the only people I came in contact with. Now, of course, I saw on occasions, and I knew that people were also ordering in weapons and arms and supporting the troops and training them and running interrogation centers and all of that. But I just never came into contact with those people. So I really can't comment firsthand on what they were doing. I guess as I look back on it now, I guess I think that all of those things are probably necessary in a war. If you don't do those kind of things, you get eaten up by the other side. But I guess I had no interest in, didn't seek out, if I was at a party somewhere and those type of people were at the party, I certainly wouldn't seek them out or talk to them. Where I learned most about what was going on is when we flew around all the time with Air America pilots. Mm-hmm. And they were the types who were much more interested in that kind of thing. So I knew a lot about what was going on from others, but it wasn't from any direct contact that I would have initiated on my own. That was just not the kind of person I am.
Yes, well, now that you've mentioned Air America pilots, since they've become now part of the folklore, along with Ravens and forward air controllers, what was your experience? So, do you have any Air America stories?
I have some, yeah.
Yeah? Could you share one with us, perhaps?
Okay, I'll share one. I can share a lot.
Uh-huh.
But the one that is most personal to me was there was Air America, or Continental, I don't remember which he was, pilot. He flew porters. His name was Sip, S-I-P. His last name, I think, was Howell, H-O-W-E-L-L, or something like that. Sip was short for Mississippi.
Oh.
He was a classic redneck. If I walked into the Air America mess hall in Sam Tong, if he was sitting at the door, and I sat at a table in that area, he would go and sit sit at the opposite end of the mess hall. We never had a word together for a long time. At one point, Lima Site 50, which is Pukum, P-H-U-K-U-M, I think, is a really key site north of Sam Tong, was under attack. It's a very, very high airstrip on the top of a mountain. And the military commander there, Juo Pao, was one of Vong Pao's key military people. And there are a lot of civilians in that Pukum area. So the question was, how bad is Pukum being attacked, and is it going to fall? And if it does fall, how can we get the refugees out? The only way to move them would have been to move them by helicopter. How do we do that? Where do we take them and all that? So Pop Buell wanted me to go to Pukum to talk to the military commander there to get a first-hand sense of what the dangers were and if we had to move, where he thought the people could best be settled and all of that. So we fly out. The only person available to fly me was Mississippi Howe. And so Pop talked to him first, and he agreed to take me. So we're sitting there. He was in the pilot seat. I was in the co-pilot seat. We had very little to say all the way up to Pukum. When we got to Pukum, we noticed that occasional mortars were coming in on the strip. So he turned to me and he said, "Do you want to go in?" And I said, "Well, I have to go in. You know, Pop really needs to know." And so he said, "Well, okay, I'm going to get you in and just jump out. As soon as you jump out, I'm going to turn the plane around and take off. I can't leave the plane on the strip. I might get hit." So he got the plane in, dropped me off, took off, and he was circling, waiting for me to call him to come back. And the place socks in. So he said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And I said, "Well, it looks like I have to spend the night here because I don't think you can get back in." And he said, "Well, I got you in there. I'll have to get you out if you want to come out. You have to make that decision. You're the customer." And I said, "Well, the place might come under attack tonight, but, you know, if it does, I can walk out with everyone else." Mm-hmm. He said, "Well, I can't accept that. I'll get you out so you can get the information back to Pop." He said, "The only thing I can do is line up on the way I normally line up to land at the strip and fly by, and you can tell me, you know, how high you think I am over the airstrip and whether I've lined up correctly, and then I'll come in and try to get in." And he did that. He flew over. I told him what I thought. He came back in and dropped the plane down and actually hit the landing strip and got me out of there. And this is a guy who I had seen around for a year and a half or more, never had a word with him. Mm-hmm. He was just a racist. I mean, he would sit at the other end of the mess hall and use every N-word and thing just to make me leave the mess hall. And yet, when, you know, the mission demanded it, he put his life on the line to get me out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of people those guys were. They were truly dedicated to what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell a lot of other Air America stories, but that's the one that is, to me, the most personal one.
Yes, yes, and revealing in so many ways. When you when did you exit the program in Laos? Under what circumstances did that occur?
Okay, I was a contractor to to USAID, and then I became a USAID direct hire. The USAID had a program at that time it was called the International Development Intern Program, that allowed someone, whenever people were hired in those days, they were hired with an L on their hiring. The L meant limited appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And the rumor was, and of course it was exactly correct, that after Vietnam was over, the thousands of people with limited appointments would probably be reduced in force. So they were all specialists. You know, they were lowland rice irrigation specialists, or the kind of specialists that you can only use in a certain part of the world. So AID had this program that after 2 years, your L was dropped. It was the International Development Intern Program. I joined that, and I went to Korea as an international development intern somewhere in 1970 or 71, somewhere in there. I was in Korea for like a year and a half or so as a direct hire aid trainee, and then my L was dropped, and I was due for a regular assignment. One of the places that there was a regular assignment was in Laos, and I applied for that, and I returned to Laos in Vientiane as the deputy chief, I think, in the rural development division in Vientiane. I was there for just a short while, and a desperate request for someone to come to Cambodia came across my desk. They were actually looking for Bob Worley, who was the guy who worked in the program in Luang Prabang, I think.
Is that W-H-E-R-L-I?
I think it was W-O-R-L-E-Y.
Okay.
And anyway, I contacted Bob, and he didn't want to go to Cambodia. To make a long story short, eventually I sent a cable back to Phnom Penh saying that I would be willing to go to Cambodia. And the guy that was running the program there had known me from Laos, so he was excited about that. And so in 1974, I went to Cambodia. I was in Cambodia in 74 and early 75. So that I had two exits from Laos. One wants to go to this training program in Korea with aid, and then into Cambodia. I was in Cambodia at the end there.
What do you mean, at the end? I mean,
at the end of April 25, spring of 75,
spring
of Vietnam, 75. Cambodia, and Laos fell. I was assigned to Cambodia.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't in Laos. And a number of the people were in Laos, but I wasn't. I was in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just interested. What was your impression of the last days in Cambodia? From what I've heard from my witnesses, especially on the military side, there was this feeling that somehow America would come back into Cambodia and save it, that there'd be a renewed military mission.
Yeah, I think that was the feeling generally in Southeast Asia that somehow this was a war that we were involved in, and we had never let the Vietnamese take over those three countries, because that was just the beginning of the dominoes. So that even though we had withdrew in a sense from Vietnam in the past, that we would appear on our white horses or white helicopters and stop the communists with, you know, our full force rather than the way we were doing it before.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that never happened. What happened to me then, I went to Thailand to help set up the refugee camps to process the Vietnamese, Lao, and Cambodians that were leaving,
mm-hmm.
and at Utapao Air Force Base. So I did that for a while, working with the military were in command there, and I was just the civilian, looking at civilian affairs with the refugees and helping to out-process it to the Philippines or Guam or whatever. But I made a decision then that speaking Lao, Thai, and Cambodian, having worked with refugees for 10 years, that I could spend the rest of my career on the Lao, Thai border in refugee camps, working with people who had given their lives and made a commitment to the United States, and in a sense who we had then abandoned and left, not even gotten into the United States, but left on the border there in refugee camps.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't want to do that. So I asked aid if they would assign me to Latin America or Africa,
mm-hmm.
anywhere other than Asia, and I was assigned to Latin America. So then I went off to Latin America for quite a while.
And was there any, there's a very famous film which shows a American military advisor in El Salvador trying to teach the El Salvadorian army to fight guerrillas, communist guerrillas in El Salvador, the way Viet Cong were fought in Vietnam. I just wonder whether you ever saw any echoes of Vietnam in your Latin American service.
Very little. Of course, there were every was in Panama with when General Torrijos was there,
mm-hmm.
and mainly I worked with General Torrijos wanted someone to work with the Indians. There were three Indian tribes in Panama
mm-hmm.
who he wanted to find a way to integrate more fully into Panamanian society. So he asked Aide if we could provide someone to do that, and the Aide director asked me if I could. And so that directly tied into my experience working with the Hmong and the Lao Tung in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that they were an ethnic minority in the country, and just figuring out what the relationship was with the national government and all of that was something that I at least had some expertise in.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was American Indian, so that was also appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked in Panama and with those three groups, the Guaymi, the Kuna, and the Choco. From Panama, things got much more interesting in terms of relationships with Laos because Somoza left Nicaragua and the Sandinistas came in. President Carter wanted the United States to have a relationship with the Sandinistas to show that just because they were communists, we would support them, we would find a way to work with them. So I was asked to go from Panama to Nicaragua to negotiate a food aid program with the Sandinistas. So that was much like what Laos might have been when the communists came into Laos. All of a sudden there I was in a country with everyone in military uniform and all kind of communist dictates being laid down. My job was food aid, and our position was that we would provide the food through the International Red Cross or through some other international humanitarian group.
Mm-hmm.
Sandinistas wanted it provided to the communist bloc parties. And they said the bloc, you know, each bloc was organized into party officials who knew everything that was going on in that city block. And they wanted the food to go directly to the communist block commanders.
Yeah.
And so that was a really difficult time for me. I was there for 3 months or so, and with no success in really getting them to accept an international food aid through the Red Cross or someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But I constantly felt like that was what it might have been like had I stayed in Laos or Cambodia after the communists took over.
Mm-hmm.
I would sit around the table, there this huge wooden table that maybe sat 50 or 60 people, and they would go around the table and the honorable representative from Albania would say, in 6 months we're going to send 5 cans of sardines. Viva la revolucion! Everyone would get so excited, and they'd get to me and I would say, well, today we landed 15 C-123s full of rice. We did this, we did the other. Absolute silence, not even going to, you know, acknowledge what we were trying to do.
Uh-huh.
And so that was frustrating. But to compensate all of that, I went off from Nicaragua to Stanford University for a year, long-term training, which was exactly what I needed to decompress, to think about all of those years in Southeast Asia and what it had meant, and to figure out where I was going to go with the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So that year was certainly wonderful.
And what did you decide to do?
Well, I decided to continue with aid rather than going back to school. So I went to Peru, where I also essentially worked with the Indian groups in the mountains. And that was, again, there were some ties with Laos because the Sendero Luminoso was just starting to get really active. I was working in education.
Mm-hmm.
I would go out and go into the schools, and the Sendero had been there the night before, you know, doing community education or adult education. The blackboard would be full of all their communist stuff, and the teachers would be quickly erasing all that off so I could go in and do my aid work during the day. So that was an exciting period. After Peru, I came back to Washington, and that's probably where I had the most direct kind of experience from the past. The Kissinger Commission had just looked at Central America and determined that U.S. scholarships to the region had gone from about 8,000 down to 2,000 per year, and that communist scholarships from Russia had gone from almost nothing up to about 10,000 scholarships per year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this huge X curve with our scholarships declining over time, Soviet scholarships increasing as they were working with all of the universities in Central America. And so the Kissinger Commission decided that the U.S. needed to launch a major new scholarship initiative in Central America, and I was charged with developing that scholarship program.
Oh.
Out of the Central American Peace Scholarships Program, CAPS. And it was totally politically motivated in the sense that the money came from the U.S. Congress to counter the Soviet influence in Central America. I designed a program that would, and so the idea was that what aid had done over the years with scholarship programs is recruit people to go for master's and PhDs. And that those people were from the elite element of society because they already had university degrees from their home country. And that the Soviets were recruiting people at the grade school and high school level from the poorest parts of the country to win the hearts and minds of the poor people. So the dictate from the mandate from the Congress was about Laos is the big frustration of thinking that I was going to work on the IVS refugee team, working with refugees up in the northeastern part of Laos, working with the Hmong. And I had spent a lot of time in Washington negotiating with IVS, if not negotiating, telling them that the reason I was going was to work with the Hmong and that I wanted an assignment there, and no one had ever told me that that wouldn't happen. So I get to Vientiane, and the first thing I learned is there are only two teams, a rural development team and an education team, and that I was assigned to the education team under Bernie Wilder, and that the education, that none of the teams work in the Hmong areas. That I could join the rural development team and go work on rural development if I wanted to, but it would be in a lowland Lao area. And I was very frustrated by that. So I certainly recall going out to Dong Dok and having a small class there, being asked to teach at Dong Dok. It was a really rural, it wasn't a university at all. And the IVSers were teaching English mainly. And that was certainly not anything I had a lot of interest in. So I was very frustrated for that period of time and constantly trying to find a different place to work. Eventually, I was assigned to work with a guy named Lou Connick at the Asia Foundation. Lou Connick had a project of getting Lao monks and Thai monks together because the Thai monks were doing rural development in and around their Buddhist temples. And the idea was to get the Lao monks to learn from the Thai monks and perhaps get more involved in development. So I worked on that project for a while. It didn't come to much good because the Thai monks felt the Lao monks were communists and that the Lao monks were trying to subvert the Thai into becoming communists. And so rather than teaching the Lao rural development, they felt that the whole thing was becoming very political. I think eventually the Thai monks dropped out of the program. It was about that time that Bernie Wilder had worked out a deal to send me up to the Hmong area to work in Sam Thong with Pop Buell. So let me spell a couple of the terms. Dong Dok, I think, was D-O-N-G-D-O-K. It was the Lao University in Vientiane. The place that I eventually went to work was Sam Thong, S-A-M-T-H-O-N-G. Sam Thong was one of the big population centers in Xian Huang Province, Xiengkhouang. Sam Thong was adjacent to another area called Longcheng, Longtchieng, Longchang was a military center that was the headquarters of the secret Hmong army, the CIA headquarters in northeast Laos, and it was connected by a short road to the next valley over, which was Sam Thong, where I worked, which was the provincial capital of the freed area of Sien Quang, because the communists actually owned Sien Quangville, which was the old capital. So Sam Thong was where the district governor and the head of the school system and all of those people had their offices, since they couldn't be in Sien Quang, Sien Quangville. So that is kind of where I ended up spending most of my time in IVS, was in Sam Thong working at the teacher training school there.
From about 1967 to 1968?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so what was your first impression? You finally arrived at your Mecca, the place you wanted to go, and what was it like?
Well, you know, when the plane landed at Sam Thong, Sam Thong was maybe an hour and a half out from Vientiane, and the various airplanes they used were Porters, Helios, and H-34 helicopters. It was an hour to an hour and a half, depending on the helicopter. It was more an hour and a half flight. It was on very close to the Plain of Jars, which was the big communist headquarters where they staged all of their operations in northern Laos. As you're landing, you noted that it was a huge airstrip, and Sam Thong and Longchang, those two areas, were certainly probably the busiest airports in Southeast Asia in those days in terms of planes flying in with rice and moving refugees. Every day there were hundreds of flights out of those airstrips. So you land in this huge laterite airstrip. At one end there was a hospital, and in the middle of the strip there was a Quonset hut, and that's where the USAID and IBS and the Air America people were located. As I got out of the plane, I met the person I would be working for, a guy named Pop Buell, Edgar Buell. Everyone called him Pop. And Pop was an Indiana farmer who was very crude in language, but just really loved by the people. He's one of these guys who knew how to relate to the Hmong and the Lao, and he was everything to them. He provided, you know, schools and clinics and trained medics and trained teachers and provided rice dropped from airplanes when they were moving on the trails into their villages. He gave them agricultural seeds and tools, and you know, he was just one of these guys that was involved in all aspects of Hmong life at that time and was venerated as a god. So he was the guy I was coming to work for. And my first impression of him was that he was a pretty crude guy, and he met me at the plane, basically gave me some, he was shocked, first of all, to find out that I was an African-American, and so right away he told me a story about a military guy from White Star. I guess White Star was one of the early special forces groups that was in
Laos.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
A White Star medic who was black, who had been assigned to Sam Thong, who got involved romantically with a Hmong and was run out of town by angry Hmong with their homemade muskets. And so his first warning was never to get involved romantically there. I would be on the first plane out. His next instruction was about an IVSer who had worked there for a short period of time. I won't mention his name. He was at the conference that you were at.
Mm-hmm.
That IVSer didn't make the grade because he was too interested in the politics of what was going on there, and not interested enough, according to Pop, in the people and in development.
Mm-hmm.
Pop had also thrown him out, so he threatened me again that my job was to work in the school and to teach there, and that I shouldn't worry myself at all about what was going on up at the airstrip, or I would find myself on the first plane out of there. And then he pointed across the valley from the airstrip, about a mile away, across the valley on the mountains on the other side of the valley, see some buildings. He said, that's the school. Your job is to go over there. That's where you belong. Don't want to ever see you at this airstrip again unless I call you to come here. And then he showed me the trail and said, you're on your own. Get going. I didn't know who I was supposed to meet or where I was supposed to go, where I was going to stay. And as I was walking down the trail, he shouted to me, "I hope you speak Lao because no one over there speaks English." And he said, if you last 6 months over there, as if he didn't think I would, and you don't speak Lao, you'll be on the next plane out of here. So that was my welcome to Samtong, which was not very hospitable welcome. So I wandered down through the valley there, and of course there was a little market in the valley, and I remember walking through the market, and everyone was Hmong. I had studied 5 days of Lao, and while I was in Vientiane, I picked up a little more Lao, but I certainly didn't know any Hmong. So first of all, I didn't understand anything that was going on. The colors were just incredible. I remember the Hmong costumes. The colors just were colors that I didn't even have a name for. And I was somewhat, I guess, lost. I really was not one. I just didn't know where I was going, who I was going to meet, where I was going to spend the night that night, how I was going to communicate with anyone. And so I went on and got to the school, and eventually someone met me and showed me a house, and I went into the house. And just as I was going into the house, it was starting to get dark there. And there was a bowl of rice in the house, and that was it. So I ate the rice, and it got dark. And that night, I saw this trail of lights coming down off of the mountain at the far end of the valley. And eventually those lights came down, and they were circling around what I thought circling around my house, people with torches. And I was just certain that I had done something, that maybe a pregnant woman had aborted, or a little girl I saw jumping rope in the market had died for some strange reason, and that people were blaming it on me. And I spent that night not sleeping very much as those people marched around my house and chanted, thinking almost that they were like the KKK coming to torch me out or something. I found out later the next day that some military guy had died, and these people were mourning him. And my house happened to be next to his house, and so they were circling his house, not my house. But that made for a pretty frightening first night in Samtong.
Now, how do you spell Pop Buell's last name?
B-U-E-L-L.
And, well, what was the day after like then? That's quite a first day.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was quite a first day. I met the superintendent of the school system for Sien Quang. His name was Mualia, M-O-U-A, second name L-I-A, Mualia. Mualia spoke French well and had just a smattering of English, and he was the guy that I worked with at the school. We developed a very close friendship over time. So he basically got me oriented, showed me where the school was, introduced me to the teachers. I didn't have a clue as to what I would teach. I had not ever thought of myself as a teacher. But obviously the easy thing to do was to start by teaching English, and so that's what I did. So I ended up teaching English in the school and also teaching English to the nurses at the hospital eventually. But that certainly wasn't enough to satisfy me. So I started trying to teach math and science, which I had noticed weren't being taught very well at the school. But between my Lao not being very good and no one else speaking English, I didn't get very far with math and science. But I developed a special course that was really useful. The person that helped me with it was an education guy from Vientiane named Norman Green, who's the USAID education officer in Vientiane that had responsibilities for Northeast Laos. What I did is I started to teach teachers the basics of mechanical drawing, how to draw, you know, tables and benches and blackboards, how to measure things, and then carpentry. And then with help from Norm Green, we got sheets of plywood and blackboard paint and things like that. And I taught the kids at the teacher training school how to build their own school furniture. And the Hmong schools, when you went out to the rural areas, had really crude furniture just made out of logs or anything that they could get. They had no finished lumber anywhere. So by the time they finished my course at the teacher training school, the teachers were going out to the village they were going to teach in with the school furniture already made to put in the school and a blackboard and chalk and things that the Hmong school system had never seen before. So that program really helped install teachers almost immediately in their school systems with the villagers as important people who could help their village improve. So that program was a big hit. And so more than teaching English, I ended up doing that kind of a program for in my first days with first, you know, months with IBS there.
Mm.
I expanded that. The other thing I noticed right away is in Samtong, and then as I went out to Hmong villages, there was no playground equipment anywhere. So my next project was to start building playground equipment. And I started with stuff for kids like teeter-totters and rope climbs and swings. But then eventually I moved into making the teacher training school at Samtong into an athletic facility. I built a 440-yard track, a broad jump area, a high jump area, a basketball court, all laid out with all the proper dimensions with two baskets, a volleyball court, a badminton court, javelin and shot put areas.
Wow.
I built some low hurdles for the track. I made a softball diamond. And we started actually a Hmong Olympics. In a year or so, a lot of schools, teachers came into the teacher training school for short courses and then were going back out to their villages. They started building small sports things themselves, and I was able to give them basketballs and volleyballs and soccer balls and things like that from money from Pop Buell. Pop Buell had a wonderful program. We got hundreds of airplanes in and out of Samtong every day bringing supplies and rice and all kinds of things. And around Christmas time, Pop would cut Christmas trees from the Hmong areas because it was up high and there are a lot of pine trees. So we would backload those planes that flew back to Vientiane or back to Bangkok or Udon empty. We would fill them with Christmas trees and sell the Christmas trees, and all that money went into a slush fund. So I could use that to buy school supplies. I could use it to buy basketballs and that kind of thing. So then we had a number. The Hmong are wonderful athletes, and we were able to have some, Hmong Olympics there at the school. And we certainly got schools all over Sien Kwong not only building school furniture and having blackboards, but eventually having teeter-totters and swings and things like that, something that was just unheard of in that area. So that was what I spent. That's where I got my enjoyment. I still taught English, but I got my enjoyment from these other projects. IBS was very supportive, but the big support came from the IBS person that oversaw this was Larry Woodson.
Mm-hmm.
And Norm Green was the USAID guy that supplied the plywood. So those were my key contacts. And with him and Mualia, I was able to get involved in something that I feel was meaningful, that gave kids in that area a new quality of life, something that they had not had before.
And all that within a year?
That was in a year and a half.
Yeah. So how did you feel? Did you feel, did you hold up a pencil and say, this is a pencil in English? I mean, what kind of educational approach did you take, and how successful was it?
Okay, on the educational approach in teaching English, I found that there weren't any real good books, but I found that there are all kind of good books in Thai on how to, on English, learning English. And Thai and Lao are very similar. It takes someone who already knows how to read and write Lao just an hour or two to read and write Thai. They're very, very similar.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So I got a couple of books from Bangkok, and I used those books as my guide because I didn't really have any background myself. So that's, I use that to teach English. And then the other, the teaching of mechanical drawing and measuring and all of that, that was largely do what I do rather than having to teach. But also I was, you know, living in an area where there was no English spoken, my Lao got very good very fast.
Yes, there's nothing like total immersion.
That's
true. Was there ever another teacher assigned to the school?
No, it was very hard for Americans to come up to that area. It was a restricted area because of the secret army operations up there. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe Larry Woodson was in those early days able to come up once or twice. But in general, people from Vientiane, auditors, any kind of people like that could not come to that area. The education person, Norm Green, was trusted by Pop, and so he was able to come up a few times. But in general, Pop determined who would come to the area and who would not.
No.
Eventually, we had two other IBSers accepted into Sam Tong. The woman was a nurse at the hospital.
Yeah, Brenda Peters.
Brenda Peters, and her husband, Gary Peters. Pop was never sure what he did, but I went with Pop one day to their house, to the Peters house, and he had been working on collecting bugs, and he had these three or four frames full of every kind of bug that you can't imagine, and it just, you know, really beautifully framed with their names, their scientific names, and all of this. And when Pop saw that, he warmed up to Gary Peters. He had always felt that Gary was a do-nothing and that his wife was excellent at the hospital. But anyway, those were two IBSers who were there at the same time I was. And that happened because they really needed a nurse at the hospital. And Brenda was there, was a nurse, and was willing to come. So it was the demand for a nurse at the hospital that brought those two IBSers up there. But there was never anyone else at the school. Now, prior to me, there was, I think he was probably IBS when he first came up there. There was a guy named Don Shustrom. I don't know how you spell his last name. I would guess it's Shoustrum. Don had started out working at the school like me, but he quickly became one of Pop's refugee officers over at the airstrip. And while I was there at the school, Don Shustrom was killed at Lima Site 36. I think Lima Site 36 was named Nakhang, N-A-K-H-A-N-G. He was shot by North Vietnamese when they overran that site where he was out working with refugees. So Pop came to me one day saying, Don Shustrom had been killed. He had worked at the school. Someone from his family was coming to Sam Tong, and Pop wanted something to be done to honor Don Shustrom. And he asked me what I thought. He wanted something at the school. So I suggested to Pop that we build a library and name it after Don Shustrom. Pop scoffed at that idea. He didn't like that at all. He said, well, you know, there aren't any libraries in this part of the world, and people don't read and write. So I pointed out to Pop that there weren't any hospitals and clinics either until he started the hospital at Sam Tong, and that there are clinics now all over San Quang. And I immodestly pointed out that there were no athletic programs and no school furniture that was any good at all until I started those programs. And if you traveled around now, you could see that kind of program growing. So if we started a library there, it could be maybe the best tribute that we could make to Don Shustrom. So Pop agreed to that, and he said, what do you need? And I said, well, I need $500, and I need a building to be built where we put the library. And I need to go to Vientiane for a week and to Bangkok for a week to get books and other things like that. So Pop said, well, that's all fine, but Don Shustrom, I think it was his brother, is coming in 1 month. Can we finish the project that quickly? And I said, well, I don't know about that. If we get the building completed, I can assure you I can complete the rest. So Pop said, you leave the building to me, you get on the next plane and go to Vientiane. And so I did. And I went to Vientiane, and I went out to Dong Duc, and I went to USIA and everywhere, and I collected books. And then I went down to Bangkok, and I bought a lot of books. When I got back to Samtong with a plane full of books and other supplies, Pop had commandeered a house that was adjacent to the school, and we were able to set up a library with the card catalog and everything, and even got us one of the school teachers to be the librarian, and I taught her, you know, basically how to handle a library. By the time that Don Schustrom's brother got there, we were able to have him dedicate the Schustrom Library. So that was probably my final job as an IBSer, because right at somewhere around that time, Art Stillman was killed, and the IBSers in forward areas were all asked to come into Vientiane. They didn't want to have another, you know, attack that would leave some IBSer dead out in the field. So Pop Buell said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "I'd like to stay here and work." So Pop got on the single sideband radio, and we called Bernie Wilder and asked Bernie if he would let me stay, and Bernie said he couldn't. It was an order from IBS Washington that we withdraw everyone back to Vientiane. So Pop tells me, as I'm talking to Bernie, "Just tell Bernie that you quit IBS." So I did, and then Pop got on the single sideband radio, and he called the head of USAID, Charlie Mann, Vientiane, and he said, "I have a man here that I want to put on USAID contract this minute." That's how things worked in the old days. From that time on, I became a USAID contractor, not an IBSer, and left the school and started to work as one of Pop's refugee officers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there's a lot of questions that you probably don't have any answers to. But
can we use this to take the break?
Yes, this is perfect.
And call me back, say, in 10 or 15 minutes.
Let's... Will do.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Terrific. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, but hold on a second. Coming back from a short break, I was just about to ask, I don't know, did you ever meet Galen Beery?
I did. I knew Galen very well.
All right. And we can talk.
IBS office in Vientiane, or he was somehow associated with Vientiane.
Right.
In those days.
Right.
He was the most learned guy. You know, if IBS needed to have a historian, Galen is probably the guy who would qualify for that.
Too late. He's already done it. No. He's
very knowledgeable.
His house in Southern California is basically one giant library of his own records. He took notes of meetings of all the USAID meetings once he went over to USAID. So it's really rather a treasure house. Wonderful guy. The reason I ask is that, you know, when I was interviewing Galen, we were trying to really get a handle on the forward area project to begin with. And, of course, I can't interview Art Stillman, so I'm trying to gather as much information about his death and the reaction of IBS that we can. So when in 1968 you heard that IBSers were being recalled to Vientiane, did you already know anything about the Forward Area Project?
Well, the guy that knows probably the most about that was Mac Thompson, who was forget where he was, Nambak or somewhere.
Yes, and we have interviewed him.
Okay.
Yeah, but
I knew what it was. Uh-huh. I knew Mac Thompson and others who were forward area types, but didn't know them well, and of course I'd never been to any of their areas.
Right. What did you think
program was not forward area, it was education
right.
team.
Exactly. What was your impression of what that program was for?
Well, I guess my impression was that those guys were doing basic rural development, just like Peace Corps volunteers. They were dropped into an area that was not a contested area, but maybe an area that people wanted to stay under royal government control, and that their job was to identify rural development activities that would help strengthen the will of the people to stay with the Royal Lao government instead of getting enticed over to the communists.
Right. Now, thinking back when the days when you were an IVSer, did that sound like a legitimate activity for IVS to be involved in? I don't mean legitimate in a moral sense.
Right.
I just mean actually doing rural development that was designed to have a political goal.
Yeah, I guess I had many arguments with Fred Bransman.
I imagine you would. Yes.
Fred and I were the closest of friends, and as far apart as you could possibly be on the political spectrum.
Uh-huh.
And so whenever I came down to Vientiane for anything, I would always seek Fred out, and we would spend hours talking about whether you know. I guess my feeling was that if there's a need to do something and you can do it, it doesn't make any difference what the underlying political motivation was or where the money came from. If people are hungry and you're giving them food, you're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better, even if the money came from the CIA or for horse race betting or some source that you would not be pleased with, if the people were hungry and you had the food, then it was just for you to give them the food.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Fred felt just the opposite. If there's an underlying political motivation, regardless of the good that you can do, you shouldn't do it because the justification from doing it came from a bad source.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that. I guess I still feel that if you can do good, do good. If the money comes from a political source or from a gambling source or from any other source, but you can use it to do good, then you should use it to do good, because those higher level political motives, whatever they might be, are far distant from the people-to-people assistance if someone is in need. And I guess need is what determines that. If there's real need and you can satisfy that need, some basic human need, you should do it. So that's just a very different, there's two different ways to look at it, and Fred was on one side of that, and I'm on the other side of it.
Yes, and that's extremely well put. I especially like your analogy, by the way, to gambling, since most of our students get scholarships from a lottery here at Georgia.
That's why I brought that up.
Yes, exactly. Okay. The reason I asked is to see, and actually you've done a very good service for us, which is simply to present these different views. Because as a project, we have no position on the issue. It's just merely a question of making sure that all those positions get adequately vocalized. And I interviewed Fred, and I had a wonderful evening with him.